like a root on a dry ground. He had no form or manner that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned, every one, to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Series called Welcome to the Mess, and what we're doing is we're looking at the way that Jesus' own life and the people who knew Jesus, raised Jesus, their lives were not pretty pictures. They were messy. They were filled with all kinds of challenges and disappointments and unpredictable experiences. We see that in Joseph's life and Mary's life, and the fact that Jesus, for the first part of his life, was a refugee in Egypt, and he lived a difficult, messy life, and that intersects with the fact that we have messy lives as well. This is often called the most wonderful time of the year, and in many ways, it is a joyful time of year. In other ways, it is a very difficult time of year, especially for those who have lost people they love, who are in the middle of difficult things going on in their lives. And so we're looking at how those two intersect and how we can find hope in Jesus' life. And this morning, I want to let you know a couple other wonderful things that are happening. This, by the way, is, you know, I mentioned how generous you all have been. I'm so grateful for that as a church. Our mission is carrying forward, and we're reaching more people and impacting more and more people for the gospel. Many of you gave gifts to those families who otherwise would not have any gifts at Christmas. This is a picture of the semi-trailer that I know you're all sad to see go, that was out here, that was carried away earlier. It was a beautiful trailer, but this is the inside of the trailer just filled with gifts. This is the back part of the trailer. There were 600 gifts that were collected for families in need, and so that's over and above. You know, I tell you regularly that as a church we tithe, we give 10% to the poor, the struggling, to missionaries. This represents more than that. This is not counted in that 10%, and so I don't know how much money that is, but it's a tremendous amount, and it's just a huge blessing. So I want to thank you all for that, for participating in that. It's a great, it's an amazing thing. And Alex and Sarah Lowry, Alex is sitting in the back. Don't look at him. He doesn't want to be noticed and acknowledged. But Alex and Sarah spent literally hours and hours here organizing all of the chaos. And then they went down to Franklinton to the school to make sure the gifts arrived and were all set up properly. And just an amazing, amazing thing. So thank you all. And, you know, we sent gifts out to, I think, around 85 children of incarcerated adults in addition to that, as part of that number. So just incredible stuff. And then Friday night, there was a group that came in, and they packed 450 lunches to also be handed out in Franklinton. This is entirely separate from that other event where we collected gifts. The reason why it's dark is because the power went out on Friday, and so they're packing lunches by emergency light. So then the light came back on. This is what it actually looks like. And then Saturday, so our confirmation class did that along with some other folks. And then Saturday, the other half of the confirmation class went down to Franklinton to pass all of these lunches out. This is a picture of the Youth for Christ Center. And it's just amazing. Hundreds of people coming and getting clothing and gifts. And there are other churches involved in this. And then we went outside to pass out these lunches. And You can see the line. I know this is kind of dark, but you can see the line. It extends all the way around the building. And these are families coming to this. And so I bring all of this up. The joy that we have of participating in stuff like this is incredible. It's if you're there and you see it, it's just incredibly sobering. I mean, the end of the line, we're passing out hot chocolate and lunches, and here comes this woman who's a single mom, and she's got three daughters that are probably, I don't know, 12 and under, and there she is. She's going to stand for 2 hours in the freezing cold with her daughters to get food and clothing and gifts, and it's just, it's pretty heavy. You know, it's life is messy for many people, and it is for us in different ways. So I want to look at the messiest life of all, Jesus' life, and how Jesus' messy, difficult, painful life, I personally feel like it's sometimes, it's almost unbearable to think about this, to think about how much people suffer, how much some of you suffer, and if there were no point, it would be unbearable. But I want to read this passage because if we understand the messiest life of all, Jesus' life, and how that relates to our own lives, we can have great hope in the mess. And we can even have joy and peace, and we can pour ourselves out knowing that what we do, and even the mysterious things that we go through that just don't make a lot of sense, they do have a point, and there is a sovereign plan behind it and above it and within all of the things that are happening in our world. And we only can make sense of that through this life right here, through the life that Isaiah prophesied about some 600 to 800 years before he actually was born. Now, he existed from eternity past. He was born into the world 600 years or so after Isaiah wrote this. This is one of the so-called servant songs of Isaiah. That's what scholars call it. It's a poem. And at the time, I can't imagine that people who read this fresh from the parchment and whatever he used to write it could understand what Isaiah was talking about. But we see in retrospect, he's talking about Jesus. And this is actually one of the most oft-quoted passages in the New Testament of the Old Testament. So in Acts chapter 8, verses 30 through 35, there's an apostle, his name's Philip, and he meets this Ethiopian eunuch, a member of the cabinet of the queen of Ethiopia, and this eunuch doesn't really understand the scriptures. He's reading this very passage. He's reading a passage that says, it's actually verse 7, like a lamb he was led to slaughter, and he doesn't understand it. And Philip proceeds to explain to him that Isaiah was prophesying about Jesus. And then he is born again. He repents and believes in Jesus and is baptized right there. Philip baptizes him right on the spot. There's another passage in 1 Peter. Peter was the kind of lead apostle, and this is toward the end of his life. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, he says that Jesus himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. Quoting Isaiah 53, verse 5. One other, and there are several others, but I'll just quote one more. John chapter 12, verses 37 and 38. John says this: though Jesus had done so many signs before them, so many miracles and healing, they still did not believe in him, so that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah right here might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? So this is a very important passage in the Bible. There's an outline if you want to follow along. First question is, who has believed? That's the question Isaiah has. It's a great question. Who believes? The answer is that there are many who do not believe. But many do not. This is partly because some people just don't get it. Others want, they may see the truth and they just don't want to believe the truth. If you read this passage, if we're supposed to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, who wants to do this? Who wants to have victory through loss and victory through pain and suffering and pouring oneself out? That's what this is about. That's what the life of Jesus, the messiest life of all, is about. I think the great rival in our day to this story is the belief that the autonomous self can define what life is, can do whatever one wants, and can achieve whatever one hopes to achieve. It's the story of our day. Now, this was initiated by Eve all the way back in Genesis 3, whose husband Adam followed right along. It follows, it tracks through the early story of creation, the Tower of Babel a few chapters later, where the people decide they want to reach God. They don't need God's help. They're just going to build a tower themselves. And God, of course, frustrates their attempts because no one can ever get to God on their own. They need help. And it goes all the way through right down to today. We have two choices, essentially. It comes down to two choices. We can either acknowledge God's authority, His great authority over every aspect of our lives, or we can choose to say, I'm going to live like I want to. I want to live autonomously. In the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, there's an intellectual and writer, essayist. His name is Aldous Huxley. He was a very, very strong atheist, believed that the material universe is all that there is, and that there is no meaning inherent in the universe. We have to make of it what we want. And he's in a moment of honesty in his book of essays, it's called Ends and Means, he describes why he believes that the universe doesn't have meaning, that it's meaningless. And this is what he says. For myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, of freeing themselves. The liberation that we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system. They believed that capitalism was bad, that socialism was good, the right thing. And liberation also from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. We objected to the political and economic system because it was unjust. The supporters of these systems claimed that in some way they embodied the meaning of the world, a Christian meaning, they insisted. But there was one admirably simple method of confuting these people and at the same time justifying ourselves in our political and erotic revolt. We could deny that the world had any meaning whatsoever. The autonomous self. 100 years later, a guy named John Frame, who has written in our day, just wrote a book about the history of philosophy and theology in the Western world. He writes this: sinners do not want to live in God's world, though they have no choice about it. They recognize the truth of it being God's world to some extent, but they would very much like the world to be different, and often they either try to make it different or they pretend that it is. To unbelievers, the word of the Bible does not exist, and we are free to live by our own standards of truth and what is right. In a word, the unbeliever lives as if she were autonomous. Now, is that just unbelievers that do that? No. Look at what Isaiah says. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We each have turned everyone what? To his own way. Autonomous. It's not only in high culture or philosophy books, it's right down to our pop culture, right? It's my, just be who you are, follow your heart, be true to yourself. It's my life, it's my life, right? We hear that in songs. Billy Joel, I don't care what you say anymore. This is my life, go ahead with your own life, leave me alone. Bon Jovi, it's my life, it's now or never. Can't remember the rest, but that's what he says. We hear that all the time. In one sense, is it true? Yes, it is our life. And we have very real choices that make a real difference in the real world. In another sense, though, isn't it a joke that we think we control our lives? Who chooses to be born when they're born? Who chooses to die when they die? Some do, tragically. Most of us don't choose when we die. We don't choose what we look like. We don't. I don't choose that I have. Do you see this red thing in my eye? Hard to miss. I didn't choose that. I didn't get in a fight. I just woke up. That's what I did. I woke up 2 mornings ago. I looked in the mirror and I was like, ugh, what the? I slept. That's what happened. I have OLD, apparently. Get it? We don't choose. Some of you are late to the party, but you got there eventually. It's okay. We'll wait. Any last? Okay. We don't choose most of what our lives become. It is a gift from God. And it's either a gift from God or we rebel against that God. And it goes so quickly. James 4:14, you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. It's been cold the last couple days. Have you seen your breath? That's your life. It's here and it's gone. And I think this autonomous self does invade, and it's insidious in the Christian life as well. It just looks a little bit different. It looks something like, well, and it's a great temptation, but it looks something like, well, I know that that's what the Bible, that's your interpretation, but I interpret it differently. Okay, but this is what it says. So what do you mean? Well, I just have a different, so explain your interpretation. Well, I don't want to explain my interpretation. I just believe differently. The autonomous self is the great lie and the great temptation for whether you are a Christian or not. It is the great temptation. So how do we understand the truth and how do we obey the truth? Well, those to whom it has been revealed understand the truth and by God's grace obey the truth. What Isaiah is saying here is that none of us can say, wow, pat on the back, aren't I smart that I figured it out and I know the truth? No, you're not, and I'm not. It's been revealed to us. In fact, we could argue, if you're a Christian and you're here today, you could argue that we're actually a lot less smart than most other people. Why? Well, because that's what the Bible says, 1 Corinthians 1:26. For consider your calling, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. These things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. Through the Spirit of God, we know what is true. We all of us, if you are a believer in Jesus and you're here today, you and I, we are beggars who have been shown where the table, where the food is, and we're just trying to bring more people to the table as best we can. It's been revealed to us. And so, who is it that we believe in? We believe in the suffering servant that Isaiah describes. Look at verses 2 and 3. Would any one of us want this to be said about us? For he grew up before him like a young, he, Jesus, grew up before him, God, like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. This is the epitome of vulnerability. If you've ever been given, I don't know, on Earth Day or some Johnny Appleseed Day, given a plant that, you know, is in one of those styrofoam cups, or your kids bring one home from school and you need to water it, and, you know, let it grow up, and you water it at first, the first couple days you're really excited, and so is your son or daughter, and then after like a month you've completely forgotten, it's all dry and the plant is like, it's dead. It's just so vulnerable. This is Jesus' life. Jesus the refugee. Jesus who had to leave the country in order to survive. He was vulnerable. Would you want to be vulnerable? Would you want to be known as unattractive? All of us want to be attractive, don't we? He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Now, Jesus was a very compelling teacher, and he was a very compassionate man who healed many. But he didn't have a train of followers in his wake. He didn't have a crown that people carried for him and put on his head. He wasn't apparently particularly good looking. He was a normal guy. He had no beauty that we should desire him. He was rejected by people. He was despised and rejected by men. Verse 3. A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. not only was he rejected by people, he was rejected in the end by God. When God laid on him the iniquity of us all, my God, why have you forsaken me? If you are not a believer in Jesus and you're here this morning evaluating the claims of Christianity as opposed to the philosophy of meaninglessness or something else, I want you to understand the core of the Christian faith. The core of the Christian faith is something that fancy theologians call substitutionary atonement. And what that means, the first word substitutionary is substitute. The second word is atonement, to pay for something that is owed. And again, the Bible describes that we are not in our core good. That in our core we are desperately wanting, that all we like sheep have gone astray, everyone to his own way. And there is a tremendous, tremendous payment that is owed to the living God. And there is nothing that we can do to make it right. And apart from understanding that, you will never understand the cross. You will not understand the Christian faith. This is how John Calvin, who read this passage, how he put it. He says, if we do not perceive our wretchedness and poverty, we shall never know how desirable is that remedy which Christ has brought to us, or approach him with due ardor of affection. A-R-D-O-R, ardor, like passion, love, gratefulness of affection toward Jesus. As soon as we know that we are ruined, then, aware of our wretchedness, we eagerly run to avail ourselves of the remedy. In order, therefore, that Christ may be appreciated by us, let everyone consider and examine himself so as to acknowledge that he is ruined till he is redeemed by Christ. Let everyone consider and examine himself. Take a minute and examine yourself. Is it not true that you are constantly thinking of yourself, constantly wanting things that you don't have, constantly being angry about the things that haven't gone well? I know that's true of you. And the reason I know it's true of you is because I know myself. And you might be a little bit better. You might be a lot better than me. Or you may be a little worse or a lot worse. But the problem is that we all face the same thing. That all we like sheep have gone astray. And Jesus, if you look at verse 4 and 5, he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Verse 5. Here comes the substitution, that he paid for our penalty. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. I'm not saying that every single thing that we endure in life is easily understandable. And I'm not saying that it's easy or that it's not confusing sometimes to endure what we endure or to see the massive amounts of suffering that exist in Franklinton and all over the world. I'm not saying that we can understand some of those things, maybe ever this side of heaven. But what I am saying is that there is very practical peace that comes from knowing that Jesus paid the price for us. And I want to close with just a couple things. One, I want you to know that when you suffer, that suffering has value and merit in some way. I'm not saying it's understandable. I'm saying that it has some kind of redemptive merit in the kingdom of God. And we know this because when Jesus went to the cross, it was the most unjust thing that ever happened. It looked completely senseless. And in retrospect, we see it, that it was the greatest event that ever happened in the world. When you suffer, when you struggle, there will come a time when you are able to use that suffering and that struggle to bless other people in your life. You will be able to do that. Maybe years. But there will come a time when you will be able to use what happens in your life to bless people around you. I think the last thing is that there it is possible to have peace. It is possible to have hope. It is possible to have even joy when you go through the mess. I don't mean that you feel it all the time, but I mean that when you are going through it, you fix your eyes on Jesus, the one who went through the greatest, lived the messiest life of all. He did it so that he would save us and redeem us and bring him close to him so that we could be his emissaries in the world, so that we could go out and share the love, beauty, and grace of God with the hurting world around us. It doesn't end the mess or fix the mess, but it does help make sense of the mess. Thanks be to our great Savior.